Welcome, everyone, to the Faith Recovery Podcast, where we seek to recover faith by recovering the faith. Mm. And we're discussing today an exhortation in Nathan's book called Essential Faith.
That's the book.
Yeah. I'm Kent.
I'm Nathan.
And this is Nathan. And we're discussing one of his final exhortations in his book, which is adore Christ as one flesh.
That's correct. Yes.
Something to do with oneness.
Yes.
Something to do with worship or...
Yes.
Because adoration.
Yes, yes.
And this is an outworking of your understanding of the gospel that you write in the book.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, the contention in the book is that the gospel's enough, right? Mm-hmm. And that would be, I think, so the gospel, I was reading that book that you were reading as well. You sent me some quotes. Mm-hmm. What's it called?
You Need a Better Gospel.
You Need a Better Gospel. That's the one. It's like, duh.
Good title.
Good title, yeah. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, I wouldn't have titled my book that because people have the right gospel, you know? So in the book, the author goes and he says, "Oh, here's the gospel as I understand it, you know?" And then he goes on for like half a page of something very, very meticulously crafted, but also something that you would never remember, you know? Mm-hmm. Like it would take you a while to sit down and just memorize what he actually said. and so... Yeah, that's the difficulty, is that if I tell you God sent his son, you know, he loves you, he died for you, he's risen again. That's it, right? Mm-hmm. I think all of us have, maybe there's some who don't, but a problem understanding how that could be the rule of my life. But maybe it's familiarity breeds contempt. Maybe we expect too much in terms of guidance. But I would say that Paul, when he preached the gospel, and it's, I think it's just that, you know, and he, sometimes he would articulate it as Jesus Christ and him crucified, or the word of the cross, or he has so many short, pithy statements of the gospel throughout his writings, and you see his sermons in the book of Acts, and then other writers of the Gospels and letters in the New Testament. And I think with that, what I think what we miss is that this gospel message, this story about the chosen king, right? And it goes back to the chapter in the book called The One Word Answer, where the terms that are used, that were used by Paul, were filled with historic, religious, political significance to the point that when they would just use that, it would open a whole window into a vast history and a set of expectations. Mm-hmm. And that's what we struggle maybe to bring over, in that maybe... just years of probably religious misapplication.
Being in a different context.
Yeah, you know, well, it's left us with different definitions and expectations of the words, right? So I think that Jesus Christ and him crucified is adequate if we understand the word Christ.
Yeah, Jesus, Messiah, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so... And that's, you know, in previous conversations that we've had over the book, that the word Christ is laden with this double anointing, right? Between the political and the religious, the vertical, if you will, and the horizontal components. Which, by the way, you know, at least as we see the figure of the cross has two members, right? And so Christ is... that word, it brings together these elements, the vertical and the horizontal. And that, I think that in and of itself, if we understood that word, maybe, you know, if we were just able to help people understand that this chosen one who's supposed to be the one who brings order to our interpersonal lives and our intrapersonal life, because I think that the vertical orientation is really an attempt to address the intrapersonal self. Because inherently, when one begins to believe in an ultimate being who knows everything that they do, they have to confront themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you begin to wrestle, not with that being really so much, but with an awareness of the self. General, what's it been called by, there's some atheist students of religion who've called it the general observer. Kind of this, that the belief in God is the need, or at least the experience of someone who sees everything,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so how do we relate, you know, you may not be a believer in God, you know, but I think as Freud, who was famously an atheist, noticed and wrote about, was that we have a superego, right? There's something about us that looks at our behavior, you know, and either approves or disapproves.
Mm-hmm.
There's something there. Mm-hmm. We may call it a conscience or whatever. And so we have this intrapersonal self, and how do I appease that voice, especially if I believe it's something transcendent? And if I believe that it has some sort of a claim on my life, and that claim is based on its, maybe the fact that I owe my existence to it, and, you know, it's creator, sustainer, redeemer kind of a being, right? So, and I think that throughout history, we have this instinct toward worship, toward awe, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think just from a psychological, personal development standpoint, that instinct, I think it's critically important to a healthy individual's psyche. Because, and I think that this is observed in the book of Genesis, where the essence of sin is the attempt to rise to godhood, to grasp that sin at its base isn't so much an inclination toward evil as we would maybe bring it out in the open, state it properly. Like, I want to do harm to someone. It may be, and you know, scarily enough, that it may be an instinct for the greatest good. That we have an inclination toward fairness, let's say. And yet this craving for fairness, when taken in hand by the individual human, someone with enough determination, charisma, intelligence, whatever, to begin to make strides toward a personal vision of fairness, will result in the deaths of millions, tens of millions of people.
Yeah, we've seen that in history.
Yes, right. And so it's an inclination toward godhood, however we understand that. That there is, I think, in everyone's heart and mind, an avatar for God. You know, however we understand it. Now, even an atheist, the vision of the future, of what ought to be right, the capacity of humankind, let's say, or the collective, what the collective of humanity ought to be, is the avatar for God for them, right? That very few people have zero inclination upward. You know, maybe someone who's deeply addicted to drugs and substances has no inclination. Everyone else, even that moment of being dissatisfied, the moment of being slighted, I think reveals a vertical inclination that ought not to be, that suggests a higher truth and expectation about the way of things. So that's the vertical side of humankind. And then the horizontal side is related, you know, related to our idea of how things ought to be is the resulting community and the experience of life. And I'm saying all that to kind of pull it out of the religious milieu and say, if people will stop and observe, if people will really be reflective enough and self-aware enough to say that, you know, there everybody has a vertical component. And if you only think of the vertical component as your own personal aspiration or at least inclination toward virtue, what you think you ought to do or be. And then everyone has a horizontal orientation, your relationships, your desires to just connect. So when we talk about the word Christ, what we're saying is that wouldn't it be good if there was someone who could bring order? Because we all have a degree of disorder in those things. And I think a lot of people, a lot of us who were, for all the failings of church and religiosity and Christianity in America, if you go very far outside of a believing community or experience with other believers, into communities of people who have been irreligious for a few generations, you will find, unless those people are very well-to-do, where they don't have a lot of stressors, but in, let's just say, lower class, what I've observed is that there is a class of people, in, especially in urban southern cities or even rural southern society, there's a class of people who abstain from church because they don't fit the mold. And they've never really been a part of church. That's not their thing, right? So I'm talking about maybe the working poor, people who've, you know, they've always lived, you know, and worked and had these blue-collar lives. They spend everything that they earn. They're nominally religious, and they resort to particular vices and stuff to feel better oftentimes, you know, alcohol, gambling, things like that, that just are the thing that make them feel like life's worth living. And that's their life. And I've just, you know, I've met, ironically, we would have people who would hold their funerals at the church. When I was pastoring, and it was, these were people who were like the grandchildren of some, you know, you had some church lady who, you know, they themselves were not well-to-do. They were poor, but they were the faithful, the salt of the earth. But their children always would go, so we're not talking about generationally or religious, but we're talking about people who just got swept into a current of say pleasure or whatever, but there are people who are the lower income type, and so they begin to fit this profile. And what I've noticed is that in that set of folks, that there's just so much interpersonal dysfunction. You know, there was just a lot of infidelity, just ongoing interpersonal conflict, you know, what we would call drama. And I think, and I'm just coming to realize that, and it's not just that set of folks, but I just noticed it in them. There are probably a higher echelons too. I mean, you look at celebrities, look at that, and that's a train wreck. But that's what we're left with, I think, interpersonally, when we aspire toward just the thing in front of us. You know, just to grasp, right? Just to have a moment of relief from the grind, if that's the point of our lives. Then we begin to find that the people around us become, at, you know, after a while, liabilities. And then we begin to have conflict with them, and then we can't get along. And so we need order. Okay. So I've said some stuff. The other thing is, and I think that the reason that a lot of people don't go to church is because we just don't need something else to pay money to or to give our time to, you know? And that's what church is for most people. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't want somebody judging us. We don't want to have to give our money, and we don't want to give up our Sunday mornings.
Yeah, and in that scenario, it's obviously not seen as like the solution.
Yeah,
to my problems.
Of course. Right? Yeah.
Otherwise, we would.
Right.
Everyone would be there.
Sure. Well, and a way to grow a pretty good sized church is actually to market it as the solution to those problems. Mm-hmm. Because people do feel that, you know, and at some point they kind of reach the end of their tether and they are looking for something to just help them stay on the rails so that they can at least raise their children, mm-hmm. you know. And so we offer people that. And maybe people who are astute will realize that there's something to be gained mm-hmm. by going there. And I think that there is. But I would also counter with the fact that when somebody sees the church and religion as a drain on time, money, resources that are scarce, they're not wrong. You know, I mean, I've known people who they did come to a particular church maybe in desperation, you know, and they kind of washed up on that shore and they found a supportive community and they really benefited. But that same church had this requirement that a tenth of your income, no matter who you are and what you make, belongs to us. And, you know, there's a real, to my mind, there's a real injustice when you encounter a single mom who's trying to figure out how to pay her tithe and pay her bills, you know, and that's normal and okay and accepted and even celebrated. I feel like there's something, you know, wrong with that, despite the fact that the tithe is completely antiquated, doesn't belong in the church. That paying your religious services bill is utter nonsense in the New Testament milieu, right? It just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. But there was money did change hands in the early church. You know, so what examples can you think of money changing hands? Right, they didn't set up a general fund, and we've talked about that before. You know, they didn't have a certain amount that went to the clergy. So,
well, what immediately comes to mind is Ananias and Sapphira. They're bringing proceeds, mm-hmm. I'm thinking about the distribution to the widows.
Uh-huh.
There's money involved,
right? Yeah, Paul. You know, we get a little precedent for collecting on Sunday morning from Paul, right? When he says, when you come together, and it's 1 Corinthians 16, take up a collection. So, you know, it's kind of like Bob Hope. I don't know if you ever heard that joke where he's on an airplane and it hits some turbulence and everyone's terrified and some woman shouts, "Somebody do something religious." And he said, "So I got up and took a collection." So, yeah, that's, we get precedent for that, but you know, we don't, it's bad Bible interpretation and bad Bible scholarship to think that's precedent for rote giving of a particular amount prescribed by somebody else every Sunday ad infinitum, right? Obviously that was ad hoc. It was in preparation for Paul arriving, to take that and then give that, you know, to take it really from that church. So it wasn't even giving toward the clergy or whatever that church, but then to take it and deliver it for relief to another church in another region. So this very much not what we do. So all that to say is church can feel like, and religion really around the world can feel like something that, you know, it calls for sacrifice. These gods, they call for a piece of you. And when you don't have much to give, or even if you do have much to give, of course, those who do have much usually are the ones who give the least percentage-wise. But so what, you know, what do we do about that? You know, how do we build communities of justice, right, when there's this God who has everything, but requires that we give him what little we have, or at least a percentage, you know? And then, how do we have to give to somebody else? You know, another phenomenon that I've noticed is that in churches, or among religious people, sometimes, there's less of an inclination to give toward other causes or charities and things like that because one has already given. You know, I kind of gave at the office. But the thing that they gave to, you know, we say, well, you know, Christians are more generous, and they are, I think, you know, by and large. But a lot of what they give to is their own religious goods and services. So there's very little actual good being done in the world by percentage for the billions of dollars that are given every year to churches in America. And that I think that's a legitimate critique. So all that to say is, you know, how do we... I think the genius of God is that... And the genius of the gospel is to have a society where this drive toward worship and adoration, toward the greater than, right?
Mm-hmm. The vertical.
This upward drive, right? Mm-hmm. Is somehow harnessed for the good of the horizontal, okay, rather than at the expense of, which I think has always been the dilemma throughout history and even currently, you know, as we're sitting here today. And I think that we probably have to go to the story of Jesus and the woman at the well. In that story, I think that we find probably the best depiction, both of what has been needed throughout history, the unsettling nature of religion and as it affects human flourishing, okay, and the hope that religion offers for human flourishing. So when Jesus meets this woman at the well, for those who may not be familiar with the story, Jesus is fleeing for his life from Judea back to Galilee. And between those Jewish regions is a region of quasi-Jews, right? Hybrids, people mm-hmm. who were in the land during the during the exile, who had intermarried with the Gentiles and had their own version of what Jewish life should be, mm-hmm. the Samaritans. Now, the only person you hate more than your enemy is someone who's very close to like you, but not. That's the person you hate the very most, right? And so they were the hated ones. Now, most of the time, the Jews would go around Samaria if they were going from Galilee to Judea. But Jesus is fleeing for his life, so he goes through Samaria. And he meets a woman around noon who's coming out to a well to retrieve water. He sent his disciples into the town to find food, and he's alone with this woman. He addresses her, asks her for some water. And she points out that her people and his people don't get along, right? She says, how is it that you... Also, there's... So he's reaching out across a couple of divides, male, female, Jew, Samaritan. Mm-hmm. How is it that you, a Jewish man, ask me, a Samaritan woman, for water? Mm-hmm. How could you do this, right? Now, he says, if you'd known who was asking, then you would have asked me, and I would have given you living water. Okay. When, you know, she says, well, give me this water, she tends to take him literally. I don't know why nobody could get any sort of irony out of Jesus. You know, when he said something, they always, you know, they're really bad. They all have Amelia Bedelia syndrome or something, you know. He says, the water I'm going to give you is different, right? It's this living water that springs up, you know, give me this water. That way I don't have to come here and draw. And so he says, well, go get your husband and then we'll make this transaction. She said, well, I don't have a husband. You know, he says, yeah, that's right. You've had 5 husbands and the man that you're with now isn't your husband. Right. Mm-hmm. So he really points out she's very broken in those horizontal relationships. She is Tammy, right? you know, like if you see some of these TikTok videos, you've got, you know, sometimes they depict this lady that's a, you know, trailer person, kind of a raspy mm-hmm. voice, chain smoker, had, you know, different guy every night kind of a thing, right? Mm-hmm. So she's that girl, right? Mm-hmm. And Jesus points it out. So she says, "Sir, I see that you're a prophet. So I've got a question," right? And she immediately brings up a question about religion. So he says, your horizontal life is broken. And she responds with, "Hey, I wondered about this vertical question," mm-hmm. you know, which seems out of place, but it's not, because they are related. And so
this is the question about, you Jews say we should worship in Jerusalem.
Yes. Yeah. And so really the idea of worship, the question of worship, runs behind this whole thing. If you're familiar with the book of John, water is critically important, especially in the first 9 chapters of John, that water is a major theme throughout. So you have John baptizing early on, and then you have water being turned to wine. You have the born of the water and the spirit in John 3. You have in chapter 4 here, this woman at the well. Chapter 5, a healing at the pool of Bethesda. Chapter 6, no water except maybe crossing. You know, they're there by the Galilee. 7, he says, those who believe in me will have within them a spring of living water welling up. Chapter 8, not a whole lot of references. Chapter 9, the guy has to go and wash in the pool of Siloam. So there's water, 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 water. And this is all related to Jeremiah's lament about Israel rejecting the streams of living water and hewing out for themselves broken cisterns. Okay, so there's a critique in Jeremiah about a religious system that begins to become its own thing, like going through the motions, having the right facility, you know, having the right rituals, those kinds of things, had become something that was an alternative to an authentic personal relationship with the divine. So God saying, you know, I'm the water. I'm the one that gives you refreshing. I'm your sustenance. But you've gone to this religious, you know, formalism that is devoid of the refreshing that comes from God. And with that, when you really begin to see your satisfying of your religious drive, your worship, as taking place at a locale, okay? So if we think of worship as that which refreshes the human soul, it's something that we are, not only are we offering, but we are filling a need. We are opening ourselves, right? And if we see that as something that takes place at a particular location, an address, under a particular authority, and, you know, people who are duly authorized to minister that to us, when we see it that way, then we have a problem of access. And that's what we have at the well. Here's Jesus, and the woman points that out. You know, when he offers the water, she says, "Sir, the well is deep, and you have nothing to draw with," right? So she's saying, look, I have the access, you don't have the access, and the access is purely the fact that I'm holding a pitcher and you're not, you know? And here's somebody, and then the divide, the question is, as the woman says, you know, you say that in Jerusalem is the place to worship, and we say it's here, right? So you have the Samaritan place, and she's reluctant to offer access, right? And then you have her bringing up the fact that the Samaritans are not given access to the living water, or to the cisterns, if as it were, in Jerusalem, right? So it's about access. To which Jesus says, look, the time's coming, and now is, when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship, right? But you will worship in spirit and in truth. So there's some kind of worship that's related to this living water that is, it is always available to everyone without the gatekeepers of the previous system, right? And I think this is the genius of the gospel, part of it, you know, one element, one facet, is that with the coming of Christ, with his promise over in John 7 of the water welling up from within, that now those who would dig the cisterns and charge admission are deprived of their livelihood, of their market, right? That's the ideal. That's the dream, right? That, so if I were to say to you, okay, let me say I proclaim to you the gospel and I say, you are being offered the opportunity to become a child of God through this rebirth, this renewal, this redemption. With that comes the anointing of the Holy Spirit. And with that Holy Spirit comes a connection with God directly, that an inclusion in the divine community, as intimate as will ever be. Now, if I tell you that and you believe it and you really accept it, and now there's a community of people who all believe and accept it, what role is there for a clerical class?
Well, in theory, you may not have left much space for the clergy. You sort of closed the gap between the people and God, and now there's nobody there to be an intermediary.
Exactly. So, so now how do I worship? So Jesus says that the time is coming when the true worshipers will worship in spirit and in truth, because those are the worshipers God seeks, right?
Yeah, and he says neither on this mountain nor on that mountain.
Yes, mm-hmm. So that implies that this worship is happening anywhere and that it is mediated by the Spirit, because God is a spirit. He says God is a spirit and those who worship him must worship in spirit and in truth. Okay, so here's my take on that, is that Jesus is saying, you know, God is not served by physical ritual, you know, because he's a spiritual being. And this has been, you know, this is ancient, right, from the prophets. You know, the prophets would complain, or God through the prophets would say, why are you doing this, you know? Now, he called for that. But that sort of worship is, and I think it's analogous to writing a love letter, or I guess what do people do now?
Sending love a text? Video.
Yeah, I guess. You know, crass, I guess. It is actual making love what sexting, you know, sexting is to making love, what this kind of worship was to worship in truth. Mm-hmm. You know, that there's something at a distance, there's a desire to connect, that there's even a medium to allow the semblance of a connection for a long distance relationship, let's say. Right? And to me, that's what the Mosaic Levitical system was, is the medium through which Israel could send and receive love letters, you know, to their God. But this isn't the goal. Love letters aren't the goal. You know, it's kind of like one time I tried to call somebody and it went to voicemail, and I was leaving them a voicemail. And while I'm leaving the voicemail, I see that they're calling me back. Mm-hmm. And so I answer and I say, hey, I'm trying to leave you a voicemail. Would you hang up? And then
I don't really want to talk to you. Right. I just want to leave you a voicemail.
I'm in the middle of something here. I'm trying to leave you a voicemail. You know? I have an unfinished voicemail. I need it. You know, and it's like, it makes me think of what the Grand Inquisitor in Dostoevsky, you know, Jesus comes and the Grand Inquisitor is this religious leader. And he says, why are you interrupting us? You know, we built this amazing system and now you're trashing it. You know, why are you here? And that's kind of what I think, you know, we do when we try to retreat back to worship services. Mm-hmm. Okay. So when we, and it's very troubling, okay, it's so built into our vernacular that it obscures the gospel in my mind, that when we talk about a house of worship, going to worship services, that we have retreated to, and it worship goes all music. The way back to Catholicism, you know. Yeah, worship music, whatever, that if I were to say to the average Christian in America today, do you worship God? You know? Or how often, or whatever, you know, what would they think of immediately, right? Is going to a building, going through a particular set of things for an hour or 90 minutes or whatever, and then, going home, you know, We even chide each other. I mentioned this before when someone says, well, you know, how did you find this church service today and all that? And we go, well, it wasn't for you. And it's just, you know, because I think that the Catholics syncretized it, you know, the pagan kind of sacramental system. They really syncretized Christianity very effectively into this pagan sacramental system. Unfortunately, sadly, grievously did that. And I don't know that, I don't think we ever recovered. Because even after, you know, Luther breaks off, he's still offering the body and blood of Christ to people, you know, who have to come there and receive it as a means of grace, you know. So he stayed that close to that sacramental system regardless, okay? And I think that we still have that. And that's because there's a codependency that's realized in church that neither side wants to let go of, you know. I want to pay you to be 24/7 for God. And in return, you know, I will make sure that you're fed and clothed, and I will try to support your vision for whatever it is you think should be done, and all this is so long as we can continue. So, you know, the end of the clerical class, I think, just, you know, the clergy just won't die, you know. And it seems really obvious. Was it last time we talked about in 1 John where he says you don't need a teacher, right? Mm-hmm. We are called a kingdom of priests. You know, Peter says that. And so this is the realization that everyone in Israel is a priest. That was the hope, I think, initially, honestly. And so now through Christ we are. So how do we do that? And we've talked about how we ought to begin to form a community of, I think, intentional inequality, you know, an intentionally heterogeneous community that where you have people who are well-to-do and people who are impoverished and people who are all over the middle. And if we don't have enough variety, let's go get some, you know, because we are in the need to offer sacrifices to God that he can enjoy. So, and this is where, this is why it's in spirit and in truth, okay? So it's in spirit in that it's mediated by the Holy Spirit. So if the Holy Spirit is in you and he's in me, then we are one flesh. And this goes to, there's an obscure reference that we don't use a lot in wedding ceremonies. Maybe we should, but it probably would be a bummer because it's an indictment on divorce, right? Maybe I'll do that. My son's wedding's coming up, so don't tell him. Shh, he doesn't listen to the podcast, so there's no worry about that. But you know, so you know, in Micah, I think around what 2:10, where he talks about, no, it's Malachi, where he talks about how God hates divorce, right?
Yeah.
And so he, you know, because they're like, well, why, God, why aren't you showing up? Why aren't you rewarding us for all of our faithfulness? Right. And God says, they're like, well, and he says, but you say in Malachi 2:14, you say, why does he not? And so it says that you cover, or 13. And this second thing you do, you cover the Lord's altar with tears and weeping and groaning because he no longer regards the offering or accepts it with favor from your hand. So here's a problem, right? Here's a problem with the vertical relationship. Mm-hmm. But you say, why does he not? Because the Lord was witness between you and the wife of your youth, to whom you have been faithless, though she is your companion and your wife by covenant. Now, here's where the translation gets odd, but I'm going to press through and I'm going to kind of give it my own spin, if that's okay, and feel free to accept or reject. Okay. Did he not make them one? Okay. So I think he's referring back Adam and Eve, right? Did he not make them one? Okay. With a portion of the Spirit in their union. Okay. So what makes the man and the woman, one flesh, right? Well, we immediately think of a sexual union, right? But Malachi is suggesting that there's something beyond that, that if we think that the spirit within a person, let's go back and think about life in terms of the ancients and how they would think of life, okay? So your body remains as a unified whole because you are alive, right? Mm-hmm. When you die, it will begin to disintegrate. Mm-hmm. So it's integrated and then it will disintegrate, right? And the difference between an integrated body and a disintegrating body is breath, right? Spirit. Mm-hmm. And so...
which is like Hebrew word, ruach or something.
Right.
It's one word, breath, spirit.
Right, mm-hmm. right. And so the oneness of your flesh, right, is dependent upon the oneness of your spirit. Your spirit being within you means that you are one flesh. So if this presence of the spirit unites flesh, mm-hmm. so then a one spirit being shared between two individuals mm-hmm. makes them one flesh.
Okay. Whose spirit? God's spirit?
Yes, right? He says a portion of, well, it says the spirit, but God, you remember when mm-hmm. he breathed into Adam. And so mm-hmm. all of the stories that we read in Genesis are, I think that there's some historicity personally, but I also think that they are massively important to teach us things. So Malachi is pinging off of that, and he's saying, look, this one fleshness doesn't really occur in the animal kingdom, even though they may unite physically. And it's because the human, the distinction is that he's received this breath. Mm-hmm. And he shares this one breath, you know, with Eve. So now they're one flesh. And this is to teach us something, right? As Malachi is saying. So if that's true, if between the man and the woman is God's spirit and the man is cheating on his wife or abusing his wife or neglecting his wife or whatever, then he's doing violence to that common spirit. So here's why God is displeased at your worship, because you are abusing him. You know, you come in and you act like you want to adore him, but you're mistreating him. Why would he respond to this gift? You know, it's kind of like in some of these horrific movies about marital and domestic abuse where the man goes off and he, you know, does something terrible to the woman, and then he comes later and he gives her some flowers and says, I'm sorry we quarreled, you know, right? So that's going to fix it, right? And he says, and what was the one God seeking? Okay, so what was God seeking in this union, this spiritual union of giving his spirit into this interpersonal sexual relationship? Okay, what was his purpose? Now, here's where the translation is harder. In the ESV, it says, and what was the one God seeking? Godly offspring. Okay. This, and this is why it's difficult, because it kind of grates against our sensibilities, okay? But it was that he was seeking offspring gods, okay? So guard yourselves in your spirit, and let none of you be faithless to the wife of your youth, okay? So this is really the kind of the incipient form of what we're talking about when it comes to one flesh, right? So one flesh is depicted in the marital union. I think that as Paul is looking through the Old Testament for occurrences of the gospel, the first one is the declaration about one flesh, okay? And we've spoken about how in Ephesians 2, right? Because it's earlier in the book about the core principles we're talking about. But here, you know, you have kind of this incipient form. But what ought to result from... So I believe that the church is the fulfillment of the picture in marriage, right? Where Paul says, make every effort to keep the unity of the spirit and the bond of peace. There is one body and one spirit, right? So he's stating something is true, that this union of individuals mediated by a spirit has now transcended marriage into the community that is the church and reaches into heaven, into the community that is the entire church, including its head, which is Christ. And so there's a seamless connection between God, who is in heaven, God the Son, God the Father, who shares this one spirit with all of us, right? And now God has become one flesh with his people. So, and now his people are also one flesh with one another. So if I offer to you a drink of water, Jesus says, the least of these, he's done it to me, right? Mm-hmm. And what has Jesus asked for, right? He's asked for this woman who could not go to Jerusalem to worship. He's asked her to engage in true worship when he said, I'm thirsty. You know, I think that's critically important. When he says the moment is coming and now is, you know, it that now is part was purely that God was there in flesh through the Spirit and could receive, because of the Spirit, could receive worship in truth, simply a glass of water, you know, and so. Our focus, when we think about worship in the church, when I'm counseling us to adore Christ as one flesh, I'm really begging the church to do everything it can to try to reverse this lamentable trend towards seeing singing as worship. And because it just doesn't meet the definition of worship throughout the Old Testament, that worship is bringing a sacrifice. And instead to think, not that we shouldn't get together and sing or whatever. I don't think it should be a concert, honestly. I'm just going to be real frank. I just think it's way expensive. It's just really expensive. And not that God's short on funds or that we can't be extravagant with him, but we use that to excuse a lot of things that just congratulate ourselves. To what I would say, hewing out broken cisterns, to be honest. You know, because it's easy to give the simulation of a religious experience if you have good enough music. How you lay out your worship set and all of that can manipulate someone's sensibilities. It just can, okay? And to my mind, that is a bit of a broken cistern. Maybe it's not a bit of one, it just is one. Mm-hmm. Where I think that the real spiritual nourishment comes from truly getting involved in the lives of other believers. And it's a challenge, you know, I'll admit it's harder.
It's harder than showing up on Sunday.
Yeah.
To attend the service.
Yeah. And if you don't, you know, if you're in a church, and I mentioned this echelon of people that don't go to church, the poor, working poor, right? And what I didn't say was, is I think that that's largely the fault of the church. Because the working poor, they, I think oftentimes they have really good BS filters, or, you know, they notice it. They recognize the hypocrisy. They don't have much to gain from networking. They are people who maybe value, the things that they take pride in are things like earning what you get, and so they see the clergy as people who don't earn what they get. Mm-hmm. Do not seek to aspire, they don't aspire to these white collar roles or whatever, or at least that's not something that's ever going to be, you know, they wouldn't consider that as a possibility. And so there's a difference. Churches by and large are led by college trained professionals, and so there's a disconnect. You know, you have, by default, churches start to become very homogenous, maybe one of the most homogenous groups in the world, or, you know, sectors. And so that homogeneity begins to exclude those who are on the margins, especially those who are in the lower echelons, because they don't have enough need to come around and you know, be dependent on somebody, but they also don't have enough resources to give 10% of their means to this, you know, organization, or to really rub elbows with folks. You know, sometimes it's hard. It does take a lot, I will say, for someone who's middle income to lower income to go to a small group at someone's house who is in an upper income.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just even myself, I mean, I don't see myself as someone who was poor, but we certainly weren't well-to-do. And I remember going people's houses and just sitting on the very edge of the chair, you know, with my drink up in my lap, like, you know, trying, you know, just, you know, I'm not just going to slouch back into the couch, you know, and set my drink down on the coffee table or something. Mm-hmm. I mean, this house is just immaculate, mm-hmm. and I probably shouldn't be here right now. You know, what am I doing here? Why did they invite me? You know, and that discomfort may be a good thing. I mean, I'm not saying that rich people shouldn't have nice homes or whatever. I don't care. But I am saying that discomfort is a part of it. It's the point. It is incumbent on the wealthy person, you know, walk over and spill something on their chair, you know what I'm saying? just to be like, you know, make yourself at home, you know, have people over for random stuff, not just church gatherings, you know, to begin to make it feel like it's where they belong. I remember my good friend who grew up in the South and was, you know, in rural poor, working poor. You know, he's taught me a lot about, I don't know, relationships, hospitality, things like that. I remember we're all sitting there and watching TV in our den and to come into our house, most people come through the garage, and then the garage door opens to the den where we have our little theater room. So we're all sitting there watching TV and door opens. We're like, oh, what's going on? And he comes in, kind of looks around, walks through the room, goes into the kitchen, opens the refrigerator, looks, you know, gets some. And I'm like, you know, this is a really holy moment here. You know, this is something that's so right. Uh-huh. But that's the challenge. So when I say adore Christ as one flesh, I'm saying, you know, we need to look around. You know, Francis Chan famously had a sermon where he preached from inside of a refrigerator box. You remember that?
No.
No. And he's talking about how when you come to worship, you should ignore everyone around you and it should just be you and God, you know? And I think he's surely recanted and repented of that sermon now. But that's, yeah, this complete opposite of what it should be.
Yeah, right.
You know, if we do get together, it probably should be to walk around, find out, you know, who's in need, or to share our heart and to say, you know, I'm really struggling and, you know, if you could pray for me. And I got way more to do. And, you know, somebody want to come help me on Tuesday or something, mm-hmm. and vice versa. I mean, honestly, we should just collaborate like that. And somebody should be, and I guess I'm just talking to myself, right? Because I have this massive pride that I'm not very good at asking for help. But what I've done is I've denied people the opportunity because I'm afraid that they're going to reject me or that I'm going to feel indebted to them. But shouldn't I feel indebted? Or why would I feel indebted on the other side? You know, because it's what we ought to do. It's what we owe one another. When Paul says, don't let any debt remain outstanding except the debt to love one another, you know, I am in your debt. You are in my debt. If I help you, I'm not accruing debt on your part, you know, or some sort of assets. I'm only paying an unpayable debt.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Hmm. There you go. Adore Christ as one flesh. Do that.
Y'all go and do that, all right? We'll see you next time. If you've got questions you want to discuss further, email us to discussion@recoverfaith.org. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll talk to you soon.